Yeah. Hello, everybody.
Hi there.
Oh, hello.
There's an interesting accent.
Yes, thank you.
Gee, you fool. Welcome. Welcome to this is the serious. Sister series of the Life of Caesar podcast. This is the consular VIP show. My name's Cameron Riley. Also on the call from Virginia, the deep-throated Ray Harris.
Hello.
And our guest today on the VIP show, all the way from Manchester in the United Kingdom, Jamie Redfern. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Cameron. I'm Jamie from Merry Old England.
Now, Jamie,
that's how I introduce myself to anyone. I say, hello, Jamie, Merry Old England.
Merry Old England.
Good on ya.
Now, for the Australian listeners, Jamie, you're going to have to explain that you are not the Jamie Redfern they think you are. Could you just do that for me?
I am not the Jamie Redfern who was host, was it America? No, Australia Talent Time or something?
He was
I don't know. I know something about him.
Yes.
because he always pops up on the internet.
In the 70s and 80s, he was a child star on a television show in Australia called Young Talent Time. Actually, might have been the 60s and 70s. Yeah, he was like a child star, grew up, had like a solo career, disappeared forever, and no one knows what happened to him. And I think some people think, well, he went to England, put on a fake British accent and is doing history podcasts. That's how far he's fallen.
Nice.
But you're not him. I'm pretty sure you're not him.
Pretty sure.
Okay.
I'm 90% sure that I'm not him.
I think you're probably 20 years younger than him for a start.
I may have like what's that film called? The Jim Carrey one. Eternal Sunshine, The Spotless Mind?
Yes. Eternal Sunshine, The Spotless Mind. Great, great movie.
I regretted my career decision, so I went through that brain rush thing, and I don't remember it anymore.
Oh, yes. Wouldn't it be so good if we could do that, just erase our memories?
There you go.
I'd erase the
and
memory
it changed
of,
my accent as well.
I'd erase the memory of how we started this podcast a couple of minutes ago, because that was a completely debacle. And I'd erase the memory of when my wife told me a couple of days ago that the Caesar podcast is boring.
Yeah. Ouch.
I wish that it never happened.
In your defense, I think she has really bad taste. Sorry, I think I'm helping. I'm not sure. I don't know.
Did I invite you to come and visit me in April? Really? Did I
yes,
say
you
could come and hang out with me?
Ray, right. Yes. Yeah. Sleep on my couch, Ray. Yes.
Yeah, sleep on this, Ray, is what I was meant to say.
It's good, folks.
As you can probably tell, folks, we don't have a serious academic scholar as our guest number two on the VIP show. Otherwise, we would be, you know, not clowning around as much. We have a fellow podcaster, Jamie Redfern. You may know him from such podcasts as The History of Pod, The History of Hannibal, History of Alexander. What else have you done that I've forgotten, Jamie?
Wow.
I do the Arab Spring history as well.
That's right.
I do modern history.
Modern history.
And
good for you.
Modern history.
I have not. I should listen to the Arab Spring one. And do you? Yeah, I haven't listened to that. By the way, can you hear this?
Yes, what is that?
That is coffee, my friends.
Okay.
It's very early in the morning. Uncle Cam did not get much sleep last night, so he's pouring coffee.
I don't know if you want to do this in a certain order, but I really did want to hear your thoughts, because we've been covering Cicero almost as much as Caesar, because he was such an important person. I really would like to dig down as much as possible into the relationship or lack thereof between Caesar and Cicero. I just find both men very fascinating, but they're very different men, but they certainly bring considerable talents to the Roman scene at this time.
Yeah, that is very true. With the network of alliances that Caesar was organizing, that became the, or that we know as the first triumvirate, which Cicero was almost a part of.
Mm. Yeah, I couldn't tell. It's like he doesn't strike me as a very martial person, but he certainly had the courage to stand up to Caesar and in the first triumvirate. And but the way I'm trying to remember the number of times he told Caesar no whenever Caesar was trying to offer him something or like a stretch out his hand in friendship or maybe even at least an alliance. But Cicero ends up telling Caesar no several times, and that takes a certain type of courage. I mean, it's not like he was a warrior or had a sword in his hand or a lot of experience, but he certainly found it within himself to tell Caesar to bugger off a couple of times. And I just thought that was very courageous and that Caesar's charm seemed to not work on him.
Oh, that's interesting that you think it's courageous. I would take the opinion mm-hmm. that he was a bit silly to do what he did to. I guess he was very principled.
Right.
But by doing so, he kind of pushed himself out of the picture of deciding events. Maybe he could have made a more harmonious system of sort of made the alliance system more harmonious and prevented the civil wars had he been a part of it rather than standing on the outside looking in.
Oh, good point. Yeah, and I certainly didn't mean to convey that I admired him. I thought it was a huge mistake on his part. I just kept wondering where that either self-centeredness or courage was coming from. I just found it astounding that he just kept turning down this very charismatic man over and over again.
Well, that's definitely a sense of courage.
One of our dear listeners, Steve B., who I'm sure is listening, has been having an email conversation with us over recent weeks about Cicero in defense of Clodius. And he makes the excellent point, and we mentioned this a number of times on the show with regards to Caesar, but it's also true that nearly everything we know about Cicero, I think, comes from Cicero. So his own extant letters and speeches. So, you know, everything that we know about this guy who was supposedly courageous and brave and standing up to the evil, corrupt, wannabe tyrants of Rome is coming from him. Is it possible, Steve B. posits, that, you know, Caesar and Clodius and these guys were lovely, you know, reasonable, middle-of-the-road kind of guys.
Yeah.
And Cicero was just completely batshit fucking insane. And, you know, as a psychopath who just hated everybody and made himself out to be the hero. Is that feasible?
Well, I think that has a lot to do with sort of the portrayal of the period is that how much of it comes from Cicero's point of view, which is partly why I like him so much.
Mm-hmm.
I like how he makes himself appear to be in the middle of everything.
Mm.
One of my favourite things about Cicero is his relationship with Pompey. And how when you read sort of less when he's talking about his correspondence with Pompey, how he makes himself seem like Pompey's personal advisor. Like, oh, Pompey looks up to me. He listens to my advice. He does what I say, when history doesn't reflect that at all. That Pompey didn't care anything about what Cicero thought.
Wow. Yeah.
So there was a serious question, actually. Do we know much about Cicero outside of Cicero's own writings?
Well, there's Plutarch's Life of Cicero. And Plutarch's one of the best sources for the period, I'd say. There's the history by Pollio, who Plutarch used a lot.
Right.
Though that's slightly later. Pollio is a someone who was involved slightly later in the Civil Wars. He was a big fan of Mark Antony, and so he sort of disappeared when Augustus came to power, and he decided to write his history, which was very pro-Antony, which didn't survive, quite obviously. But Plutarch and Appian and the other sources would have made heavy use of Pollio, and he's one of the biggest sources that we don't have, that there's no record at all of what Pollio wrote, other than we know he was pro-Caesar, pro-Clodius, and pro-Mark Antony.
So did Cicero have his own allies? Were there any other worthy men of Rome, maybe his equals, that were his allies? Because he seems to be going along his own course. Some, you know, in his earlier life, he's a part of Pompey's life. Later on, he's able to become consul, even though he's a new man. But he just doesn't seem to have joined any others to either protect himself or to further any causes. He just seems to be this really good lawyer, a very good speaker, and people love to listen to him speak, but he just didn't seem to be a joiner, if you will.
I like to think that Cicero is like the perfect example of just how far confidence can get you, like how far you can bluff your way into power.
Right.
Because he didn't have any power base at all. Like, he was just some guy who was good at speaking, and he kind of talked his way into becoming friends with Pompey, at least so he says. And I think he kind of becomes like part of the Optimates. What are they called? The Optimates?
Yeah, Optimates. He didn't seem to be a full-fledged member. He was like kind of on their side. They used him, he used them, but not really one of the group. Yeah,
he was like a mouthpiece, I'd say.
Good point. Yeah.
Do you guys know where the word Cicero comes from? His cognomen?
No.
Is it chickpea?
Very good, Jamie. Chickpea.
Yay.
Oh, yes.
Chickpea. You know, not the most inspiring of nicknames.
Not the most martial. Yeah. Wow.
Apparently one of his ancestors had a cleft in the tip of his nose that resembled a chickpea.
Oh.
According to Plutarch, anyway. Yeah, so Cicero just kind of managed to be smooth enough. You say a good speaker, powerful speaker, that's all it took. There had to be more to it than that when he became consul. I mean, you know, we know that, you know, he became consul in 63 BC. We know from his own writings how corrupt the consular elections were. Surely he had to beg, borrow, and steal the funds to become consul the same as anybody else. He must have had some... must have had some friends. He must have had some dirt on his hands.
Not too familiar with his consular election, other than that he was the least bad option, I think, like for the conservatives.
This is what Noam Chomsky said about voting for Obama. He's going to be he's going to be horrible, but he's the least horrible option.
Basically, that's the view that the conservatives talk like, oh, this guy is trying to push his way into power. At least he's better than Catiline. That sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't remember any names, and I apologize for that. But from what I was able to gather reading a couple of books, Cicero seems to have been a like you were saying, a compromise candidate, which, of course, no individual is going to see themselves as that. They're going to see that they won, they got in, they were deserving, and maybe there's a touch of greatness to them, and the fact that he is a great speaker, I'm sure he's got a healthy ego just like everybody else, and I'm sure he saw the results of the consular elections the way he would want to see them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
Yeah.
But this is the problem that I have with Cicero, is he just makes himself out to be a good guy. You know, we've talked about in Caesar's commentaries how it seems to be reasonably balanced in areas, although Caesar always comes out on top as victor, excuse me. But with Cicero's stuff, you know, it's very hard to see the grey in Cicero's writings about what's going on. He's always the guy with the morals and the ethics and the integrity, fighting against the pricks. And I don't know. We have Plutarch comes along, you know, a century later and, you know, writes a biography. We think, okay, maybe he based some of his stuff on Pollio, but we don't know what that was. It's just very hard. It's very hard for me to have a view about Cicero, except I'm skeptical. I think whenever I read anything that Cicero writes, I'm like, yeah, well, you would say that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But can I flip that on you?
Yeah.
And say that it's a clearer work because you know how Cicero, that Cicero is portraying himself as the good guy, whereas Caesar is the more deceptive work because you read it and it appears balanced, and that the most deceptive works are the ones that appear balanced.
Ah, that's a good point.
Caesar always portrays himself in the third person as the narrator, which is a very clever device because it makes himself appear neutral.
Yes. Mm. But, yeah, I mean, but at least as far as we know, the commentaries were seen to be fairly neutral in the day. So maybe he did a good job at being neutral. And that it wasn't just a device used in a cynical fashion. Maybe he honestly did try and write an honest account of the campaigns.
Mm.
If not, Cicero would have told us, surely. I mean, if they weren't, Cicero, we would have somewhere Cicero going, that Caesar is so full of shit with his commentaries, man.
Although, well, how would Cicero know? Because no one else is there to contradict Caesar. He's alone, off in Gaul, doing his campaigning. No one other than his subordinates are there to contradict him. Although, no, Cicero's brother was there, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
Quintus.
Later on.
So, I mean, you'd have to think that there are people coming and going from the campaigns. There was, you know, a lot of sort of minor nobility in as his suck-up two ICs. You know, I don't know. I mean, whenever you read analysis, historians analyzing the commentary, they say, well, he couldn't get away with just straight up bullshitting because word would get back from Gaul to Rome about what had gone on. So right. I don't know, man. Whereas, you know, Cicero is obviously just making himself out to be a good guy. He's not even trying to be balanced. At least Caesar must have been trying to be somewhat balanced, is my theory.
Or was forced to, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Jamie, can I ask you a question? At the risk of ruining our entire podcast, the regular show, for me, Cicero's great moment in his life has not come yet. Even though he was a consul, he was a new man, now his family is ennobled. For me, the greatest period of his life in a lot of ways was when he later on is able to do battle, not literally, with Mark Antony and just doing his best with his voice to bring Mark Antony low. I can't wait till we get into that, because that's a very exciting part. But to me, the best parts of Cicero's life are not here yet. And I was just wondering what you thought was Cicero's greatest moment while he was in Rome.
I think that I'd have to go with the Catiline conspiracy as his finest hour.
Right.
That, like, the moment when he truly was at the center of the state. Like, he likes to think in his letters, in his writings, that he is the center of the state always. But for that one moment, he actually was.
That's a good point. Can I go back to something you said earlier? That his high point was when he was consul and the whole Catiline conspiracy. I thought it was either sad or unfortunate or whatever that he could not convince enough of the senators to get on his side. And so it was a very controversial thing to have those people executed. So here's a man who's very good with his words, yet that very talent fails him when he needs it the most to bring over, including Caesar, a number of important senators so they can see the situation the way he does. I just thought that was one of the great, I don't know if missed opportunities or just unfortunate moments in his life when he couldn't make them see the light the way he saw it.
I think it's definitely something that would haunt him, is that throughout his career that the execution of the senators was the thing that's remembered, yeah, and not his courage, not his determination, not his saving the state, but the execution, is that's what got remembered.
Maybe it wasn't possible because he was a new man and they were more, they came from more established, families. So maybe no matter what he said, he certainly wasn't going to get them to go against their own, to side with a new man. So maybe just the culture of Rome was class against system. Him.
Yeah,
there wasn't much that he could do about it.
That he was going to not end up coming out of it well, no matter what he decided to do.
Right. Yeah. What's your favorite Cicero story, or maybe one of your favorite Cicero stories that you haven't told us?
In Latin, please.
My favorite.
In Latin. Story. In Latin. No, not in Latin. Please don't.
I was trying to remember a single Latin word, and they all failed me. Apart from the word coquus, which means cook.
Lovely.
That's very helpful.
Oh, you coquus.
Coquus.
Is that how you use it?
Coquus, kelat, aulam. That means the cook hides the pot.
Ah.
And it's also something you can order at a brothel in Rome. It's a sexual position, I believe. Still today, number, very, very popular with a certain kind of deviant.
Number 26, actually.
The cook hides the pot.
Yeah. Okay.
I would explain how it works, but I know we've probably got children listening. So.
Yeah. So let's not. Yeah.
We'll do that later. We'll do that in the adult version of the VIP show.
Yeah. There we go.
Adults only.
I can draw things with stick figures, but never mind. We'll get to that later.
Can you do a flip book for us?
I'm working on it right now as we talk.
I want to get back to this subject. So, you know, this idea of can we believe Cicero's account of Rome from his extant writings. So the argument that I was putting forward to Steve B in our email conversations was that, well, you have to look at, and look, I'm not going to go into the details of textual criticism of historical documents because I don't have the training. But if we look at the writings that we have of Cicero, like they typically break down into his speeches that we have records of, his writings on philosophy and rhetoric, and his letters. There's something like moreover 900 letters written by him to friends and to his brother. So if you think about those sorts of documents, and we think about the credibility of those documents. So let's look at speeches. If we have written versions of the speeches that he was giving in the Senate or in you know the court cases, you have to think, well, he's giving this speech to the people, assuming that this is the legitimate copy of the speech he was giving.
Right.
Yes, he may have had a view that wasn't necessarily the same view as everyone else, particularly obviously in a court case or in a speech on something in the Senate. But if we think about modern examples, we think about somebody giving a speech in the House of Parliament or Congress in the United States or wherever, they're not going to be, sometimes they do get up and speak complete and utter bullshit. But, you know, we have to think that majority of the time they might have a spin on what's going on, but they're going to be putting forward a version of the truth. There has to be a certain level of credibility in the content of their speech, or they're just going to get completely laughed out of Dodge. And so I think we can accept that his speeches, either given in a political situation or a legal situation, have to have a fairly high degree of credibility, at least as a version of the truth. They can't be out and out falsehoods all of the time. You could make that case, but that's going to be probably hard to argue. Let's forget about his writings on rhetoric and philosophy. That's obviously, his view on how things work, and that's purely subjective. But then, if we look at his letters that he's writing, when you're writing letters to people, you particularly in that day and age, he's obviously trying to communicate in how he thinks, how he feels, or how he wants the recipients of the letters to think he thinks and feels about what's going on, contemporary events, et cetera, et cetera. Now, a lot of these letters were to his brother Quintus, as we, I think we mentioned when he was in exile a couple of episodes ago, after Clodius sort of scared him out of Rome. You know, he's writing letters to his own brother. These letters are going to be about what's really going on. They can't be completely insane. They can't be making statements that are categorically false or over-the-top criticisms of contemporary, you know, people or contemporary events. So, you know, I think that from my perspective anyway, whilst we should always keep in mind that Cicero is one guy and he's not writing as an historian with a balanced view. He is writing, everything that he writes is purely subjective. It's his opinion of what's going on. I do think his writings, in terms of historical documents, probably are fairly credible. That would be my argument. Yeah. Whilst we always have to, you know, remind ourselves that this is one guy's opinion on things, but I do think they're probably pretty credible. What do you guys think about that? Hello.
Yeah.
Is this I'm here. Hello. Testing. Hello.
I was waiting for your brilliance to shine down. Okay, now that it's calmed down. Yeah, I think to a certain degree, just like Caesar, he couldn't have strayed too far from the truth because a lot of people would have called him on it, and he couldn't have simply vented and said everybody was insane in his letters. I mean, because they would have called him on that as well. So in his letters, he does have to stay pretty close to the truth, but that doesn't mean you don't skew. I mean, that certainly doesn't mean you don't spin and try and lead, which he was very good at, lead the reader to a conclusion that he himself agreed with, which is completely different from his speeches, because I can't remember how many times when he'd have a trial, even his enemies, even though the people who are going to vote against him, they've been paid, they already know they're going to vote against him. When he comes up, they literally just sit back and relax because they know they're in for a show. It might be 30 minutes, it might be 3 hours or whatever, but they know that they're going to be given some top-level entertainment. And so you really can't trust his speeches in court, but his writings, you'd like to think, because of, like you were saying, everybody else would call him on it, he would have to stick fairly close to the truth with his own individual interpretation.
Yeah, and I think if you compare, okay, I know I've already scared off all the religious listeners anyway, but if you let's take two examples. You take Cicero's letters, and then you take, you know, Paul's epistles in the New Testament or the Gospels of the New Testament. And if we try and examine the historical credibility of Cicero's writings versus those writings, I mean, it's very easy to tell. Well, for a start, Cicero's writings, we know that they were written by Cicero because he's put his name on them. And we're fairly sure that he actually did write the letters and the books, the works, the speeches, and we can tell a little bit about his credibility. With the New Testament Gospels, we don't really know who wrote them. They're anonymous, and they're obviously religious documents that are supporting a religious belief that these people had, and people that, you know, are trying to put forward a religious viewpoint. It's obviously not exactly credible as an historical document. I want to make that point. What they say is going on when, you know, if you have somebody who's part of a religious cult today and they're trying to tell you why their leader is the reincarnation of Jesus, you know, you obviously are going to take that with a grain of salt as an historical document because you know that they're coming from a particular religious perspective. Where, right. You know, Cicero isn't trying to put out any particular religious viewpoint. We know who wrote it, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I think we can look at these documents and try and think, okay, well, what was this person's agenda? Was this person – who were they writing to? We can look at a whole bunch of different factors around the writings. But the other thing that I think about is, you know, his stuff on rhetoric and philosophy, like the books that he wrote later in his life around sort of 46, 45, 44 BCE in his, you know, quasi-retirement. Mm-hmm. You know, you can read those, and it's very difficult for people that are completely crazy and insane not to appear completely crazy and insane in their writings. Case in point, two cases in point. Grab a copy of Mein Kampf and read it. And you know, straight up, this guy is batshit crazy, right? I mean, you know, I think it's very difficult for somebody who isn't, who is, you know, okay, I don't think actually Hitler was insane, but he was, his viewpoint was extreme, and it comes out in his writings. I mean, you can read it, and very quickly you go, wow, whew. This guy is out there, man. Like, that's kind of – that's nuts. On the flip side, and I use this example a lot, and I'd love to do a series on the Cuban Revolution at some stage too, because I think it's an important subject that a lot of people, particularly Americans, don't really understand very well. But about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago, Fidel Castro's autobiography came out. It was actually, a transcription of a bunch of conversations that he had with a French journalist over many, many years, and him telling his story. Now, when I read that, and I read Fidel's own words about what happened and decisions that they made, you know, during the revolution and afterwards, and he talks quite openly and honestly about mistakes that they've made in running Cuba and things that they thought that would work and didn't, and, you know, the process that they've gone through in terms of screwing up, you know, making mistakes, trying to figure out how to do this, how to run this small island nation when, you know, you're up against economic sanctions and attempted invasions, et cetera, from the world's greatest superpower that's just, you know, a couple of miles to the north of you. When I read his writings, I go, you know, this guy sounds sane to me. I mean, he gets depicted by a lot of, particularly, you know, US media as being an insane autocrat tyrant. But when I read his writings, I go, yeah, I don't get that vibe, man. I mean, I haven't met him personally, but when I hear his speeches and I read his writings, he just comes across as like he's got his head screwed on. Again, versus Mein Kampf, or if you heard Gaddafi give a speech or Saddam Hussein give a speech, or, you know, any of these guys, you hear their speeches and you go, wow, like this guy is on another fucking planet. Seriously, right? So this is a long, drawn-out way of saying when you read Cicero, and I haven't read all of Cicero's stuff, I confess, but I have read a couple of books on Cicero, and I've read excerpts of his books and his speeches. He doesn't come across to me as being completely crazy. Biased, yes. Subjective viewpoint, of course. But out-and-out crazy, no. And so I guess that's the way that I in my humble, you know, amateurish way, try and figure out the credibility of some of these historical sources.
Okay. Hey, Cameron.
Yes, Ray.
What exactly is Caesar Schwag?
Well, you know, the concept of swag is, Ray, it's like stuff.
Stuff, okay. Stuff,
yeah. So the Caesar shop, lifeofcaesar.com/shop, we've got swag that people can buy. You know, there's a couple of different designs now. We're going to have a lot more in the next couple of weeks, but there's iPod, iPhone cases and other non-iPhone-y type things with the Life of Caesar logo on it. There's T-shirts, there's hoodies, there's stickers, there's throw pillows, there's tote bags, Ray. You can never have enough tote bags.
No, I have tons of them and I can use tons more. I'm glad. I'm so excited about this.
And, you know, it's kind of cool. You can get this stuff. We get a couple of bucks every time you buy something. So, you know, a bit of money back to us to support the show.
But you can
show off the fact that you know something about Caesar, so people at school, people at work, people on the weekend, you're like, dude, you're like sophisticated and shit.
Yeah. Say, well, I always was sophisticated. It's just you recognizing it just now.
So lifeofcaesar.com/shop.
Yeah, Jamie, if I could get you to weigh in on something, taking what Cam said, you would think that Cicero's if you will, newness, his family's newness to Rome, that maybe he had a certain point of view of Rome that the others couldn't see because their families and, you know, for generations had been there. But he's got to sit there and go, well, the way things are going, this is not good for the Roman Empire, the Republic in general. There's just so much corruption. Maybe he had a little more of a clearer view what was going on in the processes of elections and trials and things like that.
But he comes across to me like a dreamer.
Mm.
Like all his writings are full of talk of the Concordia Ordinum.
Right.
I think the sort of the unity of all good men. Right. And that's how the Roman state would be one. All the good men would come together and they would, like all the groups, the like the equites, the plebs, the senators, they'd all come together and they would just make it work. Right. When not taking into account the fact that society was heavily divided and he seems to have ignored it rather than try to solve the problem.
Yeah. Is that naivete or wishful thinking or both or what?
A bit of both, I think.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
That's okay. Sort of wanting to make it work, but not being able to make it work or not having any enough influence because he was a new man to be able to bring it about. He didn't have enough clout like right. Pompey did or Caesar to stamp his order on the world.
Mm. Yeah, it's okay to be a dreamer, but unless you can, you know, have a team and make a plan and take steps, it's always going to remain nothing but a dream. I wasn't breaking into song.
Are you writing a song? Yeah, I thought this is the, you know. Are you
so poetic?
Where eagles fly, are you going to break into, you know?
That's my line. No, yeah. I stole it from someone. Sorry, Jamie, I didn't mean to. Sorry.
Well, I mean, actually, I want to ask you. Okay, so you did Hannibal and Alexander series. What do you see as the connection, if any, between Hannibal, Alexander, and Caesar? I mean, I think when we think of great conquerors and generals, we tend to think of, you know, those guys, maybe Genghis, Napoleon. They all end up in the same conversations. But what do you see as the connection between, say, Hannibal, Alexander, and Caesar? The commonalities you see there?
It's very interesting you bring that up because Plutarch writes all his biographies pretty much in pairs. Like the series is called The Parallel Lives of Famous Greeks and Romans. Like they're all paired up. And Caesar and Alexander are pairs. Mm-hmm. Like the biographies are a set of those two where I think he begins his opening of the Alexander biography by talking about how Alexander and Caesar are basically the same person, sort of going off a conquering, trying to bring about a new order and then dying before they could complete it.
What about a Caesar story? Do you have a favorite or engaging Caesar story that you tell at all your cocktail parties? I don't know if you go to cocktail parties.
Where you all get together and speak Latin.
And Greek.
It's just my Thursday evenings. It's there, just what we do.
There we go.
Okay, so this is one where I vaguely remember, but hopefully you two will be able to remember it more specifically. The where he's going through a swamp on stilts.
You've got my attention.
Didn't he do that at some point?
That does sound vaguely familiar, but you're really reaching into my
memory. I can't remember the specifics.
Uh-huh.
I think it was where he had to what was it? He was trying to attack a Gallic town or something, mm-hmm. and rather than going along the traditional route, he decided to surprise them by going through the swamps, but they couldn't walk through the swamps. So he got wooden stilts for his army to walk across, and he walked across the swamp on stilts.
I got to go look that up. Everyone who's listening, look up Caesar stilts, Caesar swamp stilts. That's hilarious.
That's true. I'm 90% sure that's true, or I may have made it up.
Well, either way, it's the best story I've ever heard, so congratulations.
I love the one where he's in the baths in Rome, mm-hmm. and he bumps into a old legionary who served in his legions, and he's poor, he's got no money, he's out of the army, And so Caesar says, like, oh, what, why don't you get a massage or something? And he says, well, I've got no money. So he pays for him to get a massage or something. Oh. So the next day, Caesar goes to the baths, and then it's full of ex-legionaries, all sort of standing around, saying, oh, can we have some money, run a massage? And then Caesar just says, why don't you massage each other? Just massage each other.
Well, I was going to ask, did the first guy get a massage or a quote-unquote massage, which would really ruin it if they did each? Yeah, never mind. Never mind. That's an awesome story. I hadn't heard that one. Have you, Cam?
No, all the stilts. I believe, though, that Jamie's slightly confusing those stories are connected. All of these guys, including Caesar, were on stilts at the time. They were giving each other massages.
That would make sense.
In the baths.
Wow.
So that's, if you can picture that.
Yeah.
Caesar on stilts giving another man a massage in the Roman baths.
Wow. That explains the tall doors. I always wondered about why the doors were so high. Okay.
And Cicero was just completely, you know, horrified at this whole thing. He wrote an entire speech about it. You know, this is where Rome has got to. Men, naked men in steam baths on stilts giving each other massages. Like, so getting back to Alexander and Hannibal and Caesar, if we can, getting away from the silliness, you know, how much of their lives do you think Caesar was aware of?
As a young aristocrat, Caesar would have had a tutor who would have gone through history with him, along with other subjects such as like numeracy, literacy, like going through Homer and all that. So Caesar would have probably been familiar with the more general outlines of history. I think he'd have read things like History of Ptolemy, who became king of Egypt. He wrote a detailed history of the campaigns from his point of view, as did Callisthenes, who was the court historian until Alexander killed him. And then he didn't write any more after that.
So who do you think the contemporary Cicero is? Who can we draw a modern analogy to? Is it guys like Noam Chomsky who sit and criticize from the sidelines and write about what's going wrong with the United States? I don't know who the British version is. Actually, we also have John Pilger, who's an Australian but lives in London. I mean, these guys haven't held political office, though. I mean, is there anyone we can think of that's like a contemporary version of Cicero? Eloquent, but also has some political power?
The first thing which came to mind when you said that was the Dalai Lama.
Wow.
A sort of a...
Right.
Yeah.
Pseudo-political force.
Right.
Not really getting involved directly, more sort of envisioning what a better world would be than making a better world.
And no one listens to him.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Cicero, the Dalai Lama of ancient Rome.
Wow. I think we've got our title for this episode.
That's an interesting analogy. I would never have thought of the Dalai Lama, but yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what about a guy that actually, I mean, Cicero was, you know, he lived in Rome. He was part and parcel of what was going on. Is there anyone, I mean, you know, the Dalai Lama obviously lives in his, actually, I don't know where he lives. Where does the Dalai Lama live?
Yeah.
At Tibet?
I don't think he does.
I'm pretty sure it's Tibet.
Yeah, but I don't think he actually lives there. The Chinese would probably have him whacked. Following the failed 1959 Tibetan uprising, the 14th Dalai Lama sought refuge in India. The Dalai Lama has since lived in exile in Dharamshala, in the state of Himachal Pradesh in northern India, where the Central Tibetan Administration is also established. So, yeah, he lives in India, man.
Wow.
And, you know, I was going to say San Francisco, so, but I was close. Anyway, getting back to what we were talking about, is there anyone who lives, like, in the United States or the UK or Australia that is sort of close to power, has some political power, is a critic, a strident vocal critic of the way things are, the way things are being run? Right. No one really listens to him, but, he's there banging on about it. There is a guy in England I'm thinking of, George something.
Galloway. George Galloway.
That's right. Mm. That's the guy. Sorry, Ray, you were saying something? You don't believe them?
Well, I just, if they're in the system and they've been there for a number of years, they're probably just trying to find a new tack to stay in power, and so they don't have to go out and get a real job. So, but yeah, I mean, but he was a part of it, but he certainly saw, Cicero certainly saw the corruption to a certain degree, wrote about it, just wasn't able to do anything about it. So if anybody tries to fix anything today, unfortunately, they're met with a healthy amount of cynicism, whether it's deserved or not. Who knows?
Mm. I guess for a comparison, you could also sort of say that anyone who is sort of a senior figure within their political party, but not part of the executive, I'd say would refuse to go in the cabinet, for instance, or take up a senior figure with the administration.
Yeah, we have several former prime ministers in Australia. Malcolm Fraser's the one who comes to mind, who was much hated during his day as prime minister in the mid-70s. And he was a conservative prime minister. But now, he's quite old. He's probably in his 80s now. But he is very active on Twitter and, giving interviews to the press, criticising our current conservative prime minister and government and the previous one. And he criticises both sides of, both major parties for being immoral and inhumane and doing horrible things. He doesn't really have any power. No one really listens, but he is, very senior person who is, criticizing our government. So maybe somebody like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Seems fair.
I mean, I don't know if that's an interesting point, but I mean, I often wonder who the modern contemporaries are, if they exist. You know, it's one thing to go back and admire the Ciceros of history 2,000 years later and say, wow, if I was there back then, I would have been on Cicero's side and Cicero's king.
Right.
We have to think, well, who are the modern Ciceros? Who is trying to fight to build a better Rome, a more honest, ethical Rome today and that we should be supporting? Listening to, read, let's not just read the writings of 2,000-year dead orators, but let's make sure that we also read the writings of the modern day contemporary Ciceros and try and think about how we build a better world today, not just think about ancient Rome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well put.
Well, with that, I think we're done. That's an hour and 16.
And it's past midnight in Britain.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And that too. Well, Jamie Redfern, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us and bringing your Latin, Greek, British sensibilities to our ex-colony show. Thank you for talking to the colonials.
The provincials.
The provincials, yeah. Just to go out, for all of the young Talentine fans out there listening in, can you sing for us Close Your Eyes by the Beatles, which is the way that the Young Talentine show is used to finish by Johnny Young. I'll start along and you can sing along with you. Close your eyes and I'll miss you. Tomorrow I'll kiss you. Remember. Come on, Jamie, get into it. Remember.
I've never heard that song before.
I'll always. You've never heard this song by the Beatles before. Are you fucking kidding me?
Jamie, are you wearing a bow tie right now?
Sorry, am I not singing it in Latin? Is that the problem, Jamie? That one. I know it in Latin, but I don't know it.
Yeah,
in Liverpool.
That was the first thing we learned. Yeah.
Jamie, if people want to follow you on Twitter, it's the History of Pod, I think. Is that your main Twitter account?
Yeah, that's the one.
And nice. If they're going to go and listen to one of your podcasts, where should they start? Which is the one that you'd most recommend people jump in and listen to?
I would recommend they listen to the Arab Spring of History. Mm. So just search that on the internet and something will appear that you can listen to.
I'm looking forward to that.
Good instructions.
By the way, if my wife listens to it and sends you an email saying it's boring,
don't listen to her.
Don't be offended.
She's got bad taste. Jamie, seriously, Jamie, thank you very much for staying up late and adding your insight to this. We really do appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. I've loved doing this.
Okay, so now you can go to bed and dream about us.
I'm going to collapse. I'm going to have sweet dreams of you both.
There you go. In the bathhouse. But anyway.
On stilts.
On stilts.
I know I'm going to dream about that tonight. Anyway.
Bye, Jamie. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Take care, Jamie.
Bye.
Bye-bye.